Hello, and welcome to recording number 12 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 7th, 2021. We've just had the band with Geller, Gord, and Curly explore the ziggurat at the center of this city in the Sus. I'm not sure if it's still meant to be a Sulis city or that was a mistake, in part of the storyline. And they have discovered that someone's been there before them and found weapons and bodies, and the weapons are humanoid. So I'm going to start here. It is page 102 and paragraph 4. "Strange weapons for a band of mercenaries," noted Deirdre. "Exactly," Geller said, nodding. "Not to mention that their wielders were probably demi-humans. Still, there are the only traces that the invaders of this ancient temple were other than human adventurers. I thought that work blocking the entrance showed unusual skill." "I follow your line of reasoning, Geller," Curly said, looking from the assortment of evidence to the surrounding litter. "Oscar, see what you can discover about what prize those daemons warded, while I find if there is more to support our one-eyed detective's deductions." All right, break. So, it's interesting to note here that daemons, that they were actually, or at least... Geller thinks that, Curly thinks that they think there were three of these guardian daemons, and, I think they said demons last time. So, now the other thing is, Geller does note the work on closing off, and hiding the entrance they made to the ziggurat looks to be a demi-human, and probably by that he means dwarven, although they're saying there's also the indication that gnomes were part of this group. So they're seeing elven signs, gnomish signs, and dwarven signs, among the litter and debris left behind. And in the work of closing it off, they're probably seeing either dwarven work or gnomish work. It's page 102. I'm going to restart. It is the second paragraph from the end. "While those two were going about their respective tasks, the others assisted Geller in minutely searching the whole place once again, being careful to avoid getting in the druid's way. Eventually, the hole was done. Magic user could discover little more than what Geller had already found. Something powerful had been here, and a bit of its aura remained, intermixed with the malign essence of the altar stone. All concluded that the object protected by this place and its guardian daemons had probably been the portion of the artifact that they sought. Greenleaf had found an ancient pitted silver coin, wedge-shaped, bearing a T on one side and a reversed pyramid on the other. It was partially lodged within a crack near the stairway leading up, and its exposed edge bore shiny marks showing recent abrasion. There was only one probable answer. The intruders had consisted of a mixed group of humans, elves, dwarves, and possibly gnomes as well. They had managed to destroy the guardians of the temple, sack the place, and make off with the portion of the artifact and other loot as well. In the process, this group had been careful both to make discovery of the work difficult to uncover and to take precautions to mislead anyone who did find that they had been to the ruin, disguising their expedition to appear to have been a party of humans, bandits, or looting adventurers. This seems very bad," Geller said. "They are days, perhaps weeks gone, and we have no idea who they are or where they went." "Not weeks, Geller, that I can assure you," replied the druid. "Unless I am totally inept, They were here only days ahead of us, and after their battle with those daemons, I guess they traveled slowly for a few days. There are ways to find the route they took and what direction they are heading. Risky under the circumstances, but we must take the chance. The fate of all Earth hangs in the balance, I fear. Oh yes, agreed Oscar. Whoever was here before us served the cause of evil. That is certain. Perhaps they're not as attuned to the oneness of the cause as we think. Geller slapped his palm. Of course. Excellent thinking, Mage. If these fellows had been agents of the Scarlet Brotherhood, surely they would have had some means of placating those guardian daemons, leaving them intact to surprise others. And they could carry off the artifact's part without conflict. Come on, let's leave this stinking death chamber and return to the sunlight. There's much work to be done. The eight departed in a group, hurrying to clear the ruin and begin their preparations to discover what they could about those who had taken the subject of their quest. All right, break. I find it interesting that the Scarlet Brotherhood would be able to placate the Guardian Daemons. Because I'm thinking that the Daemons are probably neutral evil. I'm not sure, but I didn't think the Scarlet Brotherhood was. I thought they were either lawful or chaotic evil. More sense would be lawful evil for the Scarlet Brotherhood.
Yeah, I think that's what they are.
And it was commented before by us that the Scarlet Brotherhood served the lawful evil, the lawful evil, I guess, devils, that they were more in line with them.
And by their own admission, by their own admission, they're servants of Tharys Dun.
Yes, although Tharys Dun is all evil, So I don't know if they're just a branch of the lawful evil branch, but they are following Tharys Dun. I don't think that Tharys Dun is exactly worshipped by all the Scarlet Brotherhood. Because it was mentioned that the high priest, who was the commander of the fort of Strandkeep Castle, that he was high up in the hierarchy because he was the high priest of Tharys Dun, but he wasn't the leader. And if he's the high priest of Tharys Dun, then the figure who is eldest or oldest, I believe he's the one that leads the Scarlet Brotherhood, he wouldn't be. So, it does kind of speak that maybe not all the Scarlet Brotherhood is in line with the following of Tharys Dun, but definitely it's no hidden thing. So we do get a little bit more, not really much about the ziggurat and the chamber. It's pretty much all been said before about it. The guardian demons and how this is the middle level that they entered on, and that there was a higher and lower level that they could access. Three levels of the ziggurat were, accessible. And we do have a little bit more about the storyline here. We're still no complete indication that these are Uz's servants, but from what Uz said, it seemed like they were. Because he was talking to a Clavger saying that he already had the second portion of the Theopart in hand. It is, and he had mentioned that he had these, this secret group of six, one elven, one dwarven, and we could be seeing that pulled together. But nothing directly said so far that this is Uz's mark. We have this coin. An ancient silver coin with a T on one side and a reverse pyramid on the other. And I would imagine that is T for Tharys Dun. I'm just guessing there, but it sounds like it should be.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. But again, you know, we're just, you know, it's not directly said, so it's, you know, not necessarily what Gygax was thinking. All right. I'm going to restart, and it is page 103 and the last paragraph. What they discovered first was the dead body of Lorman, sprawled face down in the corridor, killed by a single sword thrust from behind. 40 or 50 feet nearer the entrance, they discovered Ash, his throat cut. Grover likewise had been murdered where he had stood between Ash and the doorway. Of Blanc and Jacote there was no sign. So those poor poor druids, they should not even have bothered naming them. They were really red shirts here, providing some carnage, you know, cannon fodder for a easy disposal when you you want to have some attack, but not damage the strength of the group. All right, so I'm going to restart. It's page 104 and the first paragraph. There, called Nkosi as they emerged from the ruin and swept the surrounding area with their gaze. In the bush, to the right, see the foot? No question, a booted foot protruded from a small clump of brush down the sloping hillside. Hurrying there, they discovered the motionless, mutilated body of the Chakyuk nomad. There were wounds on both his back and front, and nearby were signs of melee. Jacote apparently had been attacked from behind, survived the initial assault, and fought with his assailant for several minutes before being slain. "He was a tough one, Jacote," observed Gord. "The one who slew him had already half-killed him with a stroke in the back. Only Blanc remains uncounted for. I think we all know why," said Deirdre, pale-faced but with iron in her voice. Bard and the druid conferred for a moment, then began a rapid search of the surrounding area. Soon Geller came up with a tattered roll of parchment and showed it to Curly Greenleaf and the others in turn. "Here is what I surmised happened," Geller said. "Jacote was tricked into coming outside, and then he was attacked by the vile chameleon Blanc, who had used this scroll to cast a spell of silence upon himself. The blow wasn't sufficient to kill so doughty a barbarian as the Chakyuk, but he was sorely wounded before he had a chance to fight. Still, he got in his strokes. See the stains upon his tulwar. Blanc still deomered to be able to move with no sound, then picked off the three unsuspecting sentinels. What was his purpose for all this? Now my reasoning becomes nearly pure conjecture. But see if this does not follow," Geller said. "If we had discovered the next piece of the tripartite artifact, Blanc planned to somehow wrest it from us. The means had to be magical, not based on strength and weapon play, for one against eight is impossible odds, especially given our arts and skills. Blanc's masters, certainly the Scarlet Brotherhood, must have supplied him with the wherewithal, a scroll containing a time cessation spell, perhaps, to be followed up with some means of sealing us into the treasure chamber, permanently, or at least long enough for that foul bastard to make good his escape. I suppose that Blanc crept soundlessly after us once he had killed the druids, but involved as we all were with our examination of the place, none noticed him. It is likely, after all, that the swine was cloaked by invisibility as well. Once he was with us, he must have overheard all we discussed, stolen back, and even now rides with all of our steeds to inform his associates of what has happened. As the grizzled bard spoke the last words, the rest suddenly thought of the horses. As Geller had guessed, all the animals were gone. Neither man nor mount was in sight. So the assassin had a solid head start, and with the party afoot, Blanc was not likely to be caught. "What now?" asked Gord and Deirdre in near unison. "What else than that which we were planning anyway?" Greenleaf stated flatly. Oscar, now you must employ your arts to determine the direction taken by those who preceded us and gain the object of our quest. So I'll stake my life it wasn't toward the Pomarge or any other rendezvous with minions of the Scarlet Sign. Break. So here, quite a bit where Blanc has turned out to be a servant of, possibly a servant of the Scarlet Brotherhood. And like we always say, unreliable narrator, but also Geller himself is saying that this is conjecture. You know, he can't really state for certain about any of this. We know that he has found a used scroll. I believe it. He sees that it is a scroll of silence. Gygax is having these scrolls of, even if their magic power is drained, still having an indication of what the scroll was for. Now, it's hard to say what class Blanc is. He could be a very high-level assassin, or he could just be called an assassin because of his actions. The three druids who were low level were no problem, but Chakotay is a bit of a surprise that he was able to be attacked from behind. It shows that he had, Blanc had already created a level of trust among Chakotay and of course the others as well. And there is conjecture about all these spells and powers. I'm not sure the time cessation spell, it seems like a very high level one, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure it's a PHB spell or something from, one of the supplements that had come out. All right. I'm going to restart. We're on page 105, and it is the second paragraph from the end. Oscar nodded and withdrew, Deirdre accompanying him, for the dangerous business of casting a divination that involved beings not of this plane. All the others save the druid and Geller were given sectors to watch, so that while the demon crafting was taking place, no enemy could approach undetected. Charlie Greenleaf and his old friend, likewise schooled in the arts of nature and its associated powers, would seek to become one with the surrounding land, to learn who had passed, who approached, what lurked hidden from normal view. Before an hour had passed, Geller's low whistle alerted the four sentries to return to the cleared area where the others had been at work. "We learned, Curly and I," said Geller, "a group of bipeds were here some days back and went many miles to the northwest. Murderous Blanc and our horses crossed the Jewel to the south of us, reached the other bank safely, and are now some 5 miles distance, with many, many others there. Even now this multitude comes toward us, although the river stands between. There is a deep cavern north of here, a place carved by nature, and within it lairs an ancient green dragon of monstrous size and greatest evil. As Greenleaf discovered this, we both sensed it stir and rouse itself. We fear that it has been contacted and urged into action somewhere, probably by those who come against us." Here the one-eyed adventurer paused and looked at Curly. "Is there more, old friend, or did I relate it all?" Break. All right, and so Chris has put up, wow, yeah, temporal stasis, and that is a ninth level spell. So, you know, a scroll of that is, extraordinarily, extraordinarily costly and powerful. The material components are diamond, emerald, ruby, and sapphire dust, and one stone of each type also required. So quite an expensive little spell there. But of course, you know, the Scarlet Brotherhood, for something of this nature, trying to get one of the tripartite artifacts of evil, it would have, of course, you know, spend, you know, a huge amount to try to equip Blanc Now, it's not necessarily true that he had such a spell. This, again, is Geller's supposition.
Yeah, it was the only one that I could find that had the cessation of time.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of, was this temporal stasis spell.
Oh, and I think Blanc might be a monk, too. I mean, that's another possibility, because of the way that he was fighting with the polearm when they initially encountered that group who set them up.
Yes.
In Badwell, I guess it was.
Yes, that's a very interesting idea, that he is a monk. Yeah. And, you know, I could see him then, you know, because that spear, kind of like a quarterstaff, you know, fighting. That is, yeah, probably Blanc would be a monk then, yeah. And then monks are considered the higher level, you know, the higher... in the Scarlet Brotherhood Association, they are, pardon me a sec, they are considered to be the highest level. It goes thief, assassin, monk, as far as their hierarchy goes. Right. Now, the other thing here, we have the green dragon being summoned. And if you notice the cover art, I believe that is the green dragon that they're talking about from the... Caldwell cover here of Artifact of Evil. All right. So Blanc has not only stolen their horses, but he has met up with a large band that's been following them, and it looks like they've summoned up, they've awoken ancient green dragon of monstrous size. So that is quite, you know, that is... quite a beast there, because ancient and monstrous with, you know, with a dragon actually is part of the you know, the game description for the creature. So we could go and look and see what the monster manual says about the size of a ancient monstrous green dragon. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 106, paragraph 2. "Who said all truly and exactly, as a bard should," the druid answered. Then he turned to Oscar, inquiring, "And you, spellcaster of Hardby?" "Our quarry speeds northward," the mage began, "after leaving the Sus for open lands in Selene. There seems to be some dissension in their midst, for they make first northwest, as if heading for Anstad. Incredible as that may seem, then north and northeast for the Cron Hills or Whelkwood. They do indeed have the portion of the artifact, though it is heavily protected and hidden. More about them, their master, or their ultimate destination, I could not learn." "Well done," said Curly. "We know that they have the prize, are not yet at the boundary of Selene, and the general direction of their flight. It is hardening indeed, and all we could expect. Thanks, boon companion and artful mage." Oscar, always somewhat shy, simply lowered his gaze a bit and shrugged as the others smiled and congratulated him. Ward interrupted the scene after a few seconds. "Save this for another time, comrades," he said. "We are in dire jeopardy. A dragon comes, and unknown foes seek our lives. Let us set our minds on the perils of our mission and save the acolytes for the time of final success." "Correct as usual," noted Curly Greenleaf. "Here, stand round me a moment. I must needs touch each of you." He began an almost inaudible chant, gesturing and occasionally bringing forth some bit of leaf or berry, then bits of wood. About halfway through the incantation, the druid began touching each of his associates in turn, on the forehead, the hand, and the stomach. Gord had never been so included in demon crafting, and he was slightly uneasy, perhaps a bit frightened. He determined not to allow the others to see this, just as he always carefully masked all of his emotions. Whatever was to come, he knew it was meant to help, not harm, him and the others. It had better be something powerful, Gord thought, for otherwise there might be no future for any of them, not just Jokote, Ash, Grover, and poor little Lorman. Half Elven priest of nature had completed his touching and was walking away from them. His chant rose to a shout, and as he uttered the cry, Greenleaf threw his hands wide, sweeping them above his head in a near magnificent gesture. The area darkened for a split second and grew in terribly bright, just as a resounding clap of thunder nearly broke Gord's eardrums and left him reeling. Blinking and trying to shake the ringing from his ears, the young thief saw something totally unexpected. The clearing was now occupied by a pair of huge fiery horses. These tawny flame-coated steeds with molten hooves and nostrils that showered burning sparks were hitched to a large, clumsy-looking chariot, likewise fashioned of living fire. By the bound, the druid was upon the vehicle and gesturing and calling to the others. Break. All right. So here is the green dragon. Chris has provided here the monster manual. And ancient is the highest it goes. 400 and plus years old. And 8 hit points per die. So it's getting the maximum of its hit die. Now, I think, 7 to 9, so it's 9, so it's, a very powerful. Now, in second edition, I think everything is kind of pumped up. And so this is only, a 72 hit point, green dragon. Not like you might get something with, in second edition with over 100 hit points or more. Now, Curly's spell that he is drawing up is the Chariot of Sestar. Now, Dennis Sestar is the actual inventor of the druid for D&D and AD&D. So that is, a funny little, homage to him right here. So again, this is a 7th level spell. And it creates the 2 fiery horses and flaming chariot. And can carry the druid and 8 other man-sized creatures whom he or she touches. So again, this is definitely, Gygax is, he is giving a good example, if you ever want to cast this spell, of a good description of the, the components to casting this spell. This is a verbal, somatic, and material spell. And, we have a nice little description here of what that would appear like. And as always, I really do like to add this kind of thing to the game because it's so much more interesting to hear about descriptions. And I kind of think they should have given examples of when they had these component systems, they should always have had the examples of how the spell was entailed, but it certainly would increase the amount of text it would take to do it. All right.
That's interesting. I didn't know that that guy, Dennis Sestar, was the creator of the druid.
Yeah, I was at the first North Texas convention, and he was one of the guests. He lives in Texas. And they had, Frank Metzner and Rob Kuntz and, but it's a shame I can't remember the last old guard's name there, it'd been very impressive. And Sestar, he was a very, very quiet guy, but you could talk to him. And it was, it was very interesting that there. He had created this back then, and his little addition to the AD&D game. But yeah, the first druid was written up and introduced by Sestar.
Neat.
Yeah,
I think Metzner used to live around Philadelphia.
And I can't believe I've forgotten his name. The last guy lived in Cincinnati. He was one of the early guys brought in, and he had been an editor of Dragon Magazine. And for the life of me, I don't know why I've forgotten his name. I can almost picture it. But, how those things go in the call of the moment here. All right. All right, now I am going to restart. It is page 107, and we're at 6:30, so we're making pretty good time on this one right here. But there's a lot of action and, you know, fairly little lore so far. All right, it is page 107, third paragraph from the bottom. Don't stand there gawking, friends. Enemies abound, and this will draw them faster than before. Hurry, jump aboard, and let us be away with all haste. Keller, Oscar, and even Deirdre complied instantly. The rest, including Gord, hung back. All could feel the heat, see the licking tongues of flame eating the surrounding vegetation, even though it was green and moist. How those on the flaming chariot survived was unknown to them, but surely the fire would consume them if they were so stupid as to climb into that inferno. Then Deirdre stepped down, grabbed Gord by his hand, and led the reluctant thief aboard the vehicle. With that, the other three followed. Inkosi first, then Moon, followed by Patrick. Even before the last worthy's feet were firmly aboard the chariot, Hurley Greenleaf shouted words in some strange language. In response, the blazing horses pawed the ground, shot forth blasts of fire, and leaped ahead and upward. In seconds, the whole group was borne into the air, the chariot trailing smoke and flames in its wake. The druid somehow managed to guide the horses without benefit of reins or whip. They pulled the incandescent chariot ever upward and toward the northwest. Gord found he could grasp the red-glowing, flame-covered sides of the vehicle without pain or damage from the strange and wondrous fire it was composed of. Geller saw his wonderment and told the young adventurer in a shout that carried over the wind of their passage that had not Greenleaf enabled this, Gord would even now be cinders and trailing ash. Then there was no more time for idle talk, for the druid commanded that all keep an eye out for possible attack. The chariot was traveling at a speed the fastest of falcons would be hard-pressed to match, but magic was magic, and Gord obeyed the instruction to be on guard. He surveyed the land below, its features slowly growing smaller as the vehicle was drawn ever higher by the burning stallions. The jewel appeared to be a narrow, silvery ribbon only inches wide, while the swamp and trees were merely bumpy colors. Hill and cliff were discernible only by light and shadow patterns, Ford noted. Depths were impossible to judge from a height such as this. He was exhilarated by the whole experience, and had there been no impending threat of attack, he would have thought this whole episode one of the grandest moments of his entire life. "Air!" shouted Patrick, his voice nearly carried away by the howling rush of their passage. Below and to the right, a bit, something dark wings upward towards us. Curly Greenleaf peered in the direction the frightened mercenary pointed. Sure enough, there was a great winged thing coming their way, a creature nearly invisible against the mottled greens of the landscape below. He said between the tearing gusts of wind, "That's the biggest goddamn greenie I've ever seen. An ancient mossback. Look, its wingspread must be 80 or 90 feet. It's rising fast, too." "Aye," shouted Geller in reply. "Turn these flaming brutes around, and let's get away from that monstrous blaster. Big and fast as he may be, no dragon alive can keep up with this chariot." The druid complied, calling in his strange tongue to the burning horses. They obeyed instantly, curving leftward and climbing ever higher, but in a direction opposite that of the dragon. "Wait, see there," cried Oscar. Ahead was a spiraling flock of winged specks, accompanied by some horse-like shapes. This group was rising from the eastern side of the Jewel River, winging upward and in the same direction the flaming chariot was headed. They were caught between the largest of dragons and a horde of unknown foes. Greenleaf urged the steeds again, and they turned so that they tore through the air in a course nearly due west, no longer climbing, but moving straight ahead, more than 1,000 feet above the ground. This left the swarming specks out of the chase, it seemed. The Green Dragon had other ideas. Its huge wings bore it up with amazing speed, and it was flying so as to cut the distance between itself and the intended prey, coming upward on a steep, sharp angle. The chariot drew ahead, but the dragon rose higher than the vehicle and kept on climbing. Ford saw that the monster was angling now to be on a beeline behind them. "Smart old bastards, going to dive," screamed Geller. "Beware." Sure enough, the Colossus was hundreds of feet above them now. Its wings were angled, its head a streamlined shaft of destruction. It swooped down and ahead, falling as an avalanche toward the chariot and its straining steeds. Worse still, it was now also apparent that some creature, a man in all probability, sat astride the verdigris huge scales of the great worm. A break. There's, of course, a big problem in this is that if they're faster than the dragon, which they supposedly were, angling upward is not going to cut the distance. You know, I mean, what it's simply, you know, geometry that if they're traveling in a straight line, and the dragon is starting out at a distance behind them, it's going to take the dragon a greater distance to travel at an angle to come up above them. And, you know, it's simply not going to be able to catch up with them, you know. I'm not sure why Gygax thinks that somehow, by going up at an angle, it's somehow going to beat them and be able to catch up. It just is, you know, it just doesn't work that way, you know. But that is the situation they're in, is that the dragon and its mount are going to catch up with them anyway, you know. And I think it's just because Gygax didn't really understand his geometry right there.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. They should just stay in a straight line and continue to outpace the dragon.
Yeah, and he somehow thinks that it's a shorter distance traveling at an angle, but it's not. If you look at it, it's simply that with a triangle, the angled side is going to take a greater distance than the base. So if they're traveling at a horizontal, and they were initially ahead of the dragon, and if they were also faster, there's no way the dragon can catch them. But
right.
Unless somehow it increased its speed, it's just geometry. So, all right. But you know, I mean, it's a little mistake, but it's just, you know, it's. He could have, there could be many reasons he could give for why it could happen. I think he just didn't realize that it wouldn't work. All right.
Again, then he might want to drag out the fight a bit and make it dramatic because he is introducing a dragon, but could have probably done it a better way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think he didn't understand how that would work. All right. It is page 109 and the second paragraph. It was likewise Geller who detected another terrible fact. "Save your lesser spells," the bard trumpeted in his best stentorian voice so that all could hear. "I see the glow of a magical sphere surrounding both dragon and rider. If you have nothing else to do now, pray." Gore didn't notice what the others were doing. He had pulled forth his sling and loaded one of his few oblong shots of lead and silver into the pouch. Even as Geller was crying his warning and advice, the young thief was leaning so as to be able to whirl the thong bullet faster and faster above his head. The titanic green dragon was closing, and its rider seemed to be readying some attack of his own. But this did not stop Gord. If he was about to die, then he would certainly go with as furious a resistance as circumstances allowed. Nevermore would he be one to cringe or despair. With a final effort, Gord spun the sling to a blurring speed and released the heavy, enchanted missile. It sped straight and true toward its target. What effect it had, Gord did not wait to learn, for he was already setting the second and last of his magic bullets into the sling. As he cast the second bullet, the grandfather of green dragons was a mere 100 yards away and coming fast. Mouth wide in a hissing scream, huge fore talons outspread. It was evident that it was going to plummet upon the vehicle of flame fire or no, and physically attack its occupants. The force of the impact, tons of dragon traveling faster than any horse could run, would shatter even so magical a carriage as this. One of the spell workers threw up a brief, blazing curtain of fire between chariot and dragon, but the monster and its rider plunged through without seeming injury. Then the moment of truth came. The hurtling body of the skilled monster rushed past the fiery chariot, missing a collision by only a few spans. The wind of its passage nearly toppled Gord from the precarious position he had taken up to sling missiles at the enemy. The dragon was far below them in an instant, spreading its great wings and getting ready to come upward again in an arc. "What happened?" shouted Gord over the roaring of their flight. "Your last bullet took the fellow full on the head," Greenleaf called back merrily. "I saw it all as if in slow motion. His helm saved him, but the impact sent him reeling, and he must have jerked back on his reins. You've saved us." Sure enough, the dragon and its rider were too far behind now to ever catch the flying chariot. Gord silently thanked whatever had guided that second shot, and allowed that little tug that sent the dragon just a few feet off target. Galler gave him a nod of approval, and Inkosi slapped him on the back. Ahead were the first signs of the elven community of Onstad, and soon they would be safely on the ground. As they clambered down and the vehicle and strange steeds sputtered and vanished in a fizzling poof, Deirdre came up to Gord, grasped him by his lean shoulders, and planted a kiss full on his mouth. "I owe you my life," she said to the startled young thief, and she spun on her heel and strode off to join the others. Gord strolled along, trailing behind his hurrying companions, as they made for the torchlit gates of the capital of Selene. All this was a strange business, and he needed a bit of time to ponder events and settle his mind. Great. This is page 111 and the end of paragraph 9. There seems to be quite a few more paragraphs in this book, because they're changing scenes and events back and forth. I'm plenty of time left to start in on this. In that last scene, there's a couple things that I find Gord's, why there wasn't a lot of magic weapons and missiles being tossed or shot at them if Gord's could make it through. Here Chris is posting Anna Meyer's map with the hexes good of Onstad and the fairy kingdom of Selene. So they were able to make I think quite a bit of distance there, because Onstad is supposed to be right up the, by the mountains and out of the Sus and across, looks like probably up 90 or 100 miles of distance here across Selene and out of the Sus.
So, they flew quite a bit.
Yeah, and doing great speed. I found it a little cheesy to have Gord with his magic sling be what saved them by, you know, It does seem
unlikely, but this is the first time in two books that he's done that, I think.
And it's interesting, they didn't mention that he had enchanted sling stones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he could have picked them up at any point, and especially when coming to that siege, you know, but it is not mentioned. And Gygax has been pretty quick to mention. Now, the other thing is that Gord, you know, is still very uncomfortable with magic. And in these books, he really has encountered very little magic compared to a normal AD&D adventure. I mean, he's very rarely, and now he's a very high-level character. But yeah, he really hasn't, you know, real small fraction of magic, and mostly as an observer, a couple of the battles he's fought, he really hasn't done too much with magic so far. As, you know, he's not a magician, but magic being cast upon him to aid him and such, you know, it is remarkable for someone, some character so high level at this point, not to have quite a few, spells cast on him. Because if you do normally,
because thieves, as part of their skill set, get to read scrolls and stuff.
Yes, and that's why, you know, like with Blanc, it explains why that he may very likely be an assassin or a monk. And have the ability to use those scrolls. Yeah, that's, you know, that was an, you know, interesting little thing, but I just, it was very story-like rather than Gygax's normal, you know, using the AD&D rules and showing. Now, I really did enjoy the casting of the chariot. I liked the description, and I found that very useful and something that DMs can cut out and use in their own campaigns. But in general, I wasn't really impressed with the story in that Gord is just, you know, it's just that he is there being too powerful, I think. And that just seemed very out of place, that is one sling. And here, 10th level Master Thief, can decipher magical writings and utilize scrolls, except for clerical. But I guess he can use druidic scrolls as well. So, you know, I would think that Gord probably is 10th level by now. All right.
Makes sense. He got a kiss, too.
I'm going to... Sorry.
He got a kiss.
Oh, that too. Yes. Continuing the uncomfortable storyline. Nothing really, you know, there. That was absolutely fine. But right. Still, you know, reminiscent of bad possibilities. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 113, chapter 10, paragraph 1. A handful of yokels were pleading for their lives amid the smoking ruins of their thorp, as much to their own amazement as to that of the members of his company. Abney signaled that the survivors were to be given quarter. One of the men either didn't see the signal or else simply chose to ignore it. Sneering, he thrust his sword into a little girl. This was a mistake. A heavy hammer suddenly flashed through the air, and it struck the man's head with a sound reminiscent of a ripe melon hitting a stone floor. Shards of skull and bits of brain flew away with the hammer as the headless body flopped and jerked on the trampled, bloody earth. All right, break. So here we get Abney, who, if you remember, the G modules, you know, was in G3, but a much, much bigger role in these Gord novels. And so we've jumped. Again, like when we jumped to Uz, now we've jumped to Abney, and I think we're going to see a lot of that from now on, not necessarily following Gord straightway, but lots of jumping backwards and forth. You know, we have the characteristics of servants Uz. It's not mentioned yet, but, you know, I believe Omni, and there's, you know, is one of this group that had been there, and they're the ones that had taken the second part of the tripartite artifact of evil. And we see Omni using his favorite weapon, which is, you know, a hammer that can rebound and come back, returns to the caster's hand. And also one, I think, that has, you know, the ability to smash heads completely, you know, if the right die roll is rolled. So I'm going to return. It's page 113, paragraph 3. Omni caught the hammer as it returned to him and looked around at the scattered company. All were busily gathering up their booty, sheathing weapons, mounting up and readying for departure. Without comment or sign, the taciturn dwarf, the leader of the band, slung the gory warhammer around the pommel of his saddle and rode out. His small stallion cantered away, leaving the Sac community on the edge of the Whelkwood behind to the south. An uneven stream of other riders hastened after Omni. There was no order to their march, but the weaker gave the stronger wide berth. Only two others rode near the dwarf. Although he was hunted from the Crystalmas Mountains to Keeland, Omni was virtually unknown to the Reavers, who followed him now. Peek and Gleed were the only ones in the group who were familiar with the jolly-looking, closed-mouthed mountain dwarf, having accompanied Omni for several years now. Peek was a tall, skinny high elf, fratricidal and murderous, adept with both spell and sword. Gleed, an aged-seeming gnome, was likewise a rogue and outlaw, able to spin illusion or slit purse with equal skill. The lanky elf rode a gaunt horse, while the wizened gnome sat atop his own mount in a Huda-like saddle. Peek was still snickering over the fate of the disobedient brigand and trying to get the squinty-eyed gnome to share his mirth. "And did you see his face when the hammer flew near?" Peek paused to cackle with glee at the thought. It took him full in his sneering mouth, wiping that look away as cleanly as his teeth, face, and head. Heh, heh, heh. Something less permanent might have done as well was Gleed's only comment in reply. The gnome then spoke sharply to his ugly, jug-headed mount, and the horse responded by increasing its pace to draw alongside the long-maned stallion ridden by the dwarf. Peek likewise brought his animal to a faster gait, drawing up to ride at Omni's left. "Most nobly done, Lord Omni, most nobly," he said to the ruddy-cheeked leader. "I was just sharing my admiration with the good gnome, but he seems less impressed with our leader's skill and authority than I." He finished, breaking into his usual cackle. All right, break. So, you know, we're now introduced to two main characters here of Keek the High Elf and Gleed the Gnome. Both of them are dual-classed, a fighter, magic user, and an illusionist thief. Now, you'll notice, again, that Omni, like so many others, such as Uz, they're very willing to slay their own followers at a moment's notice. And as Gleed points out, it's you know, perhaps something less permanent would have done, and they would have kept up at least one more fragment of their strength. But Omni appears to share, you know, the petty arrogance that, you know, like Uz does, and how Gygax portrays Trey's evil as so full of themselves that they often act in a manner that is against their own interests. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 114, third paragraph from the end. "Bah," said Gleed. "Nobody cares what a crazy elf thinks about whether or not some useless man is brained. Abney's eyes twinkled as he looked from one to the other of his henchmen. "They need sport," he said, "and they need lessons, too. I give them both. Today there is no doubt who rules this company." As he said the last, Abney's merry gaze traveled from Keek to Gleed. Both understood the message for elf and gnome, had seen the jolly countenance of the dwarf wreathed in smiles as he wrought the most malign deeds upon foes and disobedient friends alike. Abney had power, and both of his lieutenants feared him. To provoke Abney was to invite death. "Fetch Red Bowman for me, Gleed," the dwarf said. "Make you move back, too. Ride with your ilk. Make sure they remain steadfast." Both of Abney's henchmen muttered acquiescence and turned their mounts. Red Bowman was the leader of the score of humans who rode with the band, the remnants of a company of brigands that had numbered over 50 when they had joined the demi-humans. Although the expedition had taken a heavy toll upon their number, the survivors were wealthy, and there was no grumbling or thought of desertion among them. None apparent, anyway. The wizened gnome shrugged and slowed his steed to a walk so that others would catch up with him. Keek wheeled his gaunt horse around and rode back to where a half score of various types of elves and half-elves rode together in a bunch. Near them were a handful of dwarves and gnomes riding ponies. Keek took a position behind the two groups and cackled, "Enough sport for you lads. When the hell do we get to some place where we can have some real fun?" retorted one of the wild elves. "Where the hell are we going anyway?" asked one of the dwarves. Laughing raucously, he told both lots that they should engage in anatomically impossible acts, but then he continued, "We'll be coming to our destination soon enough, and then the boss will collect the big money. Your share'll make you rich for life." "I should live so long," shouted the single high elf in the company. "Kee-hee, kee-hee, kee," snorted the lieutenant. "You won't if you keep talking like that. But then, all the more for the rest of us." The group looked blackly at the skinny, cackling elf, but then many of them grinned at the prospect of a larger share of treasure. The half-elf closed his mouth and kept it shut under Keek's wild glare. "Now that's better. I'd say that tonight we'll be camping outdoors again. Tomorrow we should hit Hill Road and spend the night in Hamlet. Good food and drink at the inn there, lads." "I'll take it all, and the women too," agreed one of the riders. "A pig's ass you will, Stubborn," replied the stick-thin elf. "Abney'll want no such business close to Verbabank. We are to pass as quietly through the border as possible, and that means we act like goody-goodies there." All right, break. So, you know, here's the mention of Hamlet. And luckily, they're not going to attack it because this group looks unbeatable by, you know, Burn and, you know, the badgers there who are the defenders of Hamlet. Now, one thing, there's this comment, "I should live so long," shouted the single high elf. And then Keek, he tells him, that if he keeps talking that way, he'll end up dead. And then the half-elf closed his mouth and kept it shut under Keek's wild glare. I think there's the half-elf is really the high elf. So I think Gygax made a little mistake right there. It's either a single high elf, or a single half-elf within the group. So we get a description of this, a band of various races of elves, gnomes, dwarves, and humans. And the humans, I guess, are, much not as strong because they've already said they've lost about 30 of them so far. We've got... a thing that for Verbabank is at least, a place where Abney doesn't want to run into any trouble, showing again that, you know, again, the evil ones, they really do seem to be able to, you know, they are, they do back down rather easily. And here we have the Inn of the Welcome Wench, always a favorite place for me. I've always loved Hamlet as an early setting. And this is Chris putting it up on the fiction text channel here. All right.
They mentioned it.
What?
Oh, they mentioned it. That's all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think we do get to see a little bit of Hamlet. I don't want to jump ahead or anything, and I may be wrong, because I'm only remembering certain bits and pieces.
I really don't remember anything, I don't think. I didn't remember that Blanc was a traitor.
Oh really? No, I didn't either. But I did remember the Green Dragon. I didn't remember the actual fight. I remembered vaguely about them having been too late to get the artifact. I remembered, but really, and this is, it has been several years, but I am, you know, a little thrown by some of the stuff, not remembering at all.
I did remember that they didn't get the artifact, okay? So at least I remember that.
Yeah. And like I was pointing out, they are jumping back and forth now. So it is a, you know, it is, he's moved into a, he's trying different things in this book. All right, I'm going to call up Craig here, and that'll be it for tonight.